waiting for our nearest and dearest to get from Beacon Hill Park down to Haven. Mm-hmm. Because then we fell in again and marched with complete panache onto the little parade ground at Naden, where we trooped a colour for ourselves and for our dependents and friends and relations and so on.
Great.
So we went through the whole caboodle again.
Yeah.
It was great ceremony and so on. And I don't remember anybody dropping a rifle or fainting or doing any of those things throughout this whole long day.
Extraordinary, really. Because I presume you hadn't done much in the way of route marches up to that point. I mean,
well, we'd done some toughening, for toughening purposes.
Oh,
yes.
I
didn't mention it before.
Yeah.
Yes, we had.
You had, yeah.
But I don't think we'd ever done one that long. I don't remember doing one that long. In fact, I don't remember doing any.
You must
much.
Have been in good shape, because that's yeah. a bit of an ordeal for anybody.
Yeah. And particularly after the nervous tension of the preceding half hour or whatever. It was really quite a thing.
Who was the senior naval officer at that time?
Brodeur.
Oh, he was?
Yeah.
Yeah, he still was.
He was one of the people who lived in Admiral's house down here. His name's on the brass plate in the lobby. He relieved Charles Beard, who had been
senior
squadron officer, was called in those days. The previous year, I guess, 38, yes. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Well, I dare say everybody was thoroughly glad to get to their messes and wardrooms.
Well, they were, yeah. But I, for one, went to a ball at the Armories that night.
Good Lord, did you?
This is ridiculous, isn't it? Yeah.
Well, as you say, you were young and
lots
of tough and energy.
Yes,
and everything.
Well, I guess
ready to go and
in very good physical condition.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Were you married at that point, Mickey?
No, I took my subsequent, who became my wife, I took to the ball.
Oh, did you? Oh, yeah.
But no, we weren't even engaged at that point.
Huh. Oh well. That's me. Now we were talking about going back. I guess we're going on forward quite a bit. We were talking about escorted the first convoy overseas.
Mm-hmm.
That was strictly a merchantman, or was it? That was just a regular.
It was the first
cargo
of the convoys, which
yeah.
went on for
yeah.
the ensuing 6 years.
Nothing special about it, particularly because it was the first one.
No, it was the first one.
Yeah.
There were merchant ships, freighters, who were laden and who were destined for that side of the ocean, and who were collected here and in Sydney, I guess. I can't remember. But certainly in Halifax, I said here, I mean Halifax, which was here then, by then for us.
Yeah.
I don't remember the size of the convoy or anything now. I can just remember that there was one.
Ships came from the American, the New York or the American
port
and gathered in Halifax.
Yes.
Yeah.
Because the Naval Control Shipping Organization, the NCSO organization, had been revving up gently for some time when it became obvious that there was going to be a war. Mm-hmm. So they had posts in American ports. Although they were very, very sub rosa, because America, of course, would be neutral, but these fellows had to pretend they were something else. And I remember, for instance, Admiral Murray, who then Captain Murray, was on the permanent joint board of defense in his capacity of deputy chief of the naval staff in Ottawa, I think it was. His passport described him as a ship chandler.
Oh, did it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's quite kind of phony subterfuge, which just sort of satisfied the legal aspect of the thing, was enjoyed by everybody.
Yeah. When you went on a wartime footing, had you additional drafts for the ships? I mean, your peacetime complement wasn't sufficient, surely, was at that point, to...
They weren't up as much as possible. We took some men from other ships here, when we left Vancouver in that hurry, I think. We certainly picked up men from Stadacona when we got to Halifax. But then, you see, the wartime recruiting hadn't yet started, not really.
No.
It got underway immediately, but it didn't show results for a couple, 2, 3, 4 weeks. But we were built up as soon as we could up to war complement, which I suppose was another 50 men out of
I was going to say, that would... In order to have a full common, you'd be working 3 watch days all day, 24 hours.
Mm-hmm. We were watch on, watch off for a while because we were short-handed.
I see. Yeah, that was a bit tough.
That's tough. You can't do that forever.
No.
But then we went to the usual three-watch system after a while and stayed in for the rest of the war.
Did you go all the way across on this?
No, we took them out. I think it was 3 days out, and then that was about a day and a half back because it came back much quicker.
You were met by the British,
were
you?
No, we just turned them loose.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
What was the point of that? Surely that you were setting him loose into the toughest part of it, weren't you?
Well, we were, but we didn't know it. In any case, we couldn't go any further.
Oh.
Because there was another convoy forming behind us.
Oh.
Had to come out, too. And the theory, of course, was that, although it didn't happen that way yet, that any hunting ground for a U-boat would be in a focal point, a focal area. Well, a focal area off Halifax, off the Nova Scotia coast,
mm-hmm.
off the mouth of the St. Lawrence, converging with the route from New York. We were covering that as best we could with the tiny resources available.
How many of them were you? How many ships?
Six destroyers.
Six destroyers.
That's about it, because the minesweeper didn't really count.
Yeah.
Not for that kind of work.
Yeah.
Because there were four. And we didn't have six destroyers there until about November, when Ottawa and rescues came round from this coast, which left no destroyers here. But then there wasn't a war here.
No.
So then we had six, and then Assiniboine joined, and we began to grow up from there.
Did you have anything at this point to do with the RN?
Yes.
In particular. Yes,
but not
ships here or people.
Yes. So this was when they had one of the great problems or fears was that the Grass Bay and the Deutschland and so on were going to get out as commerce raiders. And Grass Bay, as we know, did. She was down off in the South Atlantic. But in order to counter such a problem, the British sent battleships over. The R-class battleships were based in Halifax as convoy escorts, and they sailed in the convoy. And the occasional destroyer going somewhere else would drop by. We had a visit at one time in that fall, for instance, from the H-class, the improved H's, who were actually built for the Turks, I think, but which the RN grabbed before they ever left the UK. And they were on their way down to South America for some obscure reason which I wasn't allowed to know. I don't think I ever did discover what they were supposed to be up to, but at any rate, they came through. But the RN battleships were there, and it was they who brought out a strange tray of the Halifax people. It was a matter of some considerable concern to us from the West Coast, particularly for the sailors, that Halifax turned out in numbers to help and entertain and look after the sailors from the RN battleships who were berthed in the inner harbor there. And nobody paid any attention to our people at all. So we tried to point out to the Haligonians that we were, in fact, further away from home than those people were coming from the UK. It didn't fizz, of course, but it was a fact that our men, who grew up in the prairies but who had joined the West Coast Navy, or who grew up on the West Coast, but at any rate belonged to the Esquimalt Port Division, were further away from their home base, the Esquimalt, than the RN sailors in a battleship were from Portsmouth, by quite a lot.
Mm-hmm. This was certainly a continuing problem, wasn't it?
This was.
It's amazing, really. Whoever is running this sort of organization ashore obviously had a thing going for the RN.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's understandable in that it's been going on for generations and hundreds of years.
Yeah, true.
Because you know, Halifax had been a Royal Navy base going way back
into
the 18th century. So it's not too surprising, but it nevertheless didn't make it any more palatable for us.
No, say not.
But I say it wasn't so bad for the officers, because if we didn't know people in Halifax, we knew people who did know people, and we got absorbed pretty well. But the troops didn't have that kind of an entree.
Hmm.
It did improve, of course. But and people did buck up and make canteens available and such like things for any sailor of any kind. But there was, to the very end, I think, of this, well, certainly well into the war anyway, there was one hostel on the south end of Halifax which was only open to RN sailors, which was a shame.
Yeah, really. What, I suppose these are the old R-class battleships were, you say, put there in case of heavy German raiders. It's probably a good job they weren't too heavy, if they ever met one. Surely those ships were pretty, they must have been damn nearly obsolete, you know, lessons, certainly. I suppose later experience in the war showed they were pretty darn vulnerable to torpedoes, my gosh.
Yes. But I wasn't thinking about that. I think about gun attacks.
Yeah.
Wasn't had 15 inch guns.
Yeah.
And 8 of them. They flung a great weight of metal.
Great weight, yeah, right.
And the pocket battleships were, 11 inch?
Yeah, well,
they had
6
of them, and so gun for gun. If you could get in the first lick, you were probably all right. If Deutschland, for instance, had got in the first lick with her very sophisticated gunnery control equipment, which is better than ours, wouldn't be so hot. But anyway,
yeah, it worked.
It was a gesture.
It worked.
Well, it worked because there never was an encounter.
Yeah, right. And you had to do something. You had to show
That's right.
It certainly looked impressive. And,
oh, fine. Looks fine.
Yeah, you know.
I gather the merchant sailors thought it was great to see this great thing sitting in the middle of the convoy.
Yeah, yeah, I think so.
The top speed of 18 knots flat out. I don't know.
Well, plenty fast enough for the convoys, I suppose, because they were...
Well, yeah, they were 10-knot convoys, 8-knot convoys, 7-knot convoys, you know, depending on the what ships were making up the convoy.
That must have been a rather bit of a thorn in a way, or a frustrating thing that these companies were darn slow, I should think.
Terribly frustrating.
To everybody concerned. I don't know about the merchantmen who were used to going that speed. Well, people who were used to going faster, it must have been very frustrating.
Yes.
The guy who never plodded along any faster than that, of course.
The thing that really got him then was having to keep stationary.
Oh, yeah.
And that really got him at the beginning of the war, before they got accustomed to it.
Yeah.
But it was them. Complaints at pre-sailing conferences were, from the heart.
Yeah, really.
The NCSOs would have to stand up and say, now look, you've got to keep stationary, because if you straggle, there's nothing we can do to protect you. If you stay in the convoy, there's something we can do. It may not be enough, but at least we'll do something. But if you straggle, you're on your own.
So during the winter of 39-40, you were sailing out of Halifax, were you? As I recall, you became, executive officer of somewhere
along
there?
No, of Assiniboine.
Of Assiniboine?
That was in March, April of 40.
Yeah,
I guess
the same class of ship.
She was the leader,
of
the seas, yes, and when she was built as Kempfenfelt.
What was the actual difference, a destroyer leader against the other destroyers of the same class, apart from stripes on the funnel?
Bigger.
Yeah.
More accommodation, offices. There was an office or two for staff officers to use. A slightly larger complement because it had to accommodate a staff, a few more cabins for the same reason. That's about it. Otherwise, the same armament, same radio equipment. A little bit more radio equipment for the same reason. Not much, but a little more. We had two radio offices, one aft as well as one forward, main one forward. That's about it, really.
Did, in those days, I presume the leader had a medical officer, or did the other destroyers have a medical officer, or just...
Soon they did, pretty soon. We had not had during the war, prior to the war, because we didn't have a medical service, you know. The RCAMC did our doctor.
Yeah.
We had sick bay attendants, who were naval people, but the doctors themselves were all supplied by the RCAMC.
So when you were out exercising, there was an army doctor that came along, didn't he, aboard?
And on our long cruises and so on.
Yeah.
And I guess it was when the war broke out that RCNVR medical officers started, surgeon lieutenants started appearing. Very soon, because the RCNVR had been recruiting such people prior to the war. And I remember there seemed to be a whole bunch of them came from York, who was the division, the VR division in Toronto. And most of them, of course, were University of Toronto Medical School graduates. And fine they were, too. Now, it was, that was, oh, the fall of 39, I suppose. In fact, I remember early in 40, after I'd gone to Assiniboine, going up to Santa Cona, where they were processing recruits. And the reason I went up there was, as a first lieutenant, I thought I ought to know how to administer a hypodermic in case I had to give morphine in action.
Oh, yes. This was fairly common in the early days, wasn't it? There was an officer who...
Well, we generated several, but I was the first one of that ship because I was the first lieutenant.
Yeah, right.
And it was an RCNVR surgeon lieutenant who was doing the shots on recruits as they arrived, with whom I went and worked, and he showed me how to do it and said, "No, go ahead, you do it." And so he had one line of would-be ordinary seamen, and I had another. They didn't really think much of me.
You hadn't practiced on orange enough to
do that. No, I hadn't. But apparently it was all right. Nobody seemed to die.
You got into them anyway.
Nobody fainted. And I never had to do it for real. But still, I've never forgotten how to do it. So it might be useful someday.
You never know, right? No. Absolutely, yeah.
But still, I feel cut.
Well, thanks very much, Admiral Sterling. We'll continue this interview on the next day, next Thursday, right? On W.S. Thackeray, I'm interviewing Rear Admiral M.G. Sterling. It's the 5th of June, 1980.
Okay, ready to go. Here we are.
I don't know that any of the recruits that I inoculated had any bad, devious effects from it. And I have never had to use a hypodermic needle since that I can recall, so I don't know whether it was a very useful exercise. But the idea, I don't know that I mentioned it or not, was that I, as the first lieutenant of Assiniboine, and supposedly in a war zone, although we were based in Halifax at that point, might have to administer morphine to wounded or injured people, and therefore I'd better find out how to use a needle. And that was the basis of the thing. This fellow who taught me had the dart-throwing approach to it. But still, I can all cut.
Thanks very much, Admiral Sterling. We'll continue this interview on the next day, next Thursday, right? On W.S. Thackeray, I'm interviewing Rear Admiral M.G. Sterling. It's the 5th of June, 1980.
Okay, ready to go. Here we are.
I don't know that any of the recruits that I inoculated had any bad, devious effects from it. And I have never had to use a hypodermic needle since that I can recall, so I don't know whether it was a very useful exercise. But the idea, I don't know that I mentioned it or not, was that I, as the first lieutenant of Assiniboine, and supposedly in a war zone, although we were based in Halifax at that point, might have to administer morphine to wounded or injured people. And therefore, I'd better find out how to use a needle. And that was the basis of the thing. This fellow who taught me had the dart-throwing approach to a needle. He didn't carefully insert it into the under the skin. And a normal man, he'd stand back and throw it.
You know, I haven't experienced that for a long time. That seems out of the style, I think, hasn't it now?
It's always struck me, even from then, which was the first time I'd met it, was a rather brutal method thing. But actually, this particular doctor was a first-class basketball player, and I think he thought he was doing a layup shot or something. He'd just come into the Navy about the week before, and he wasn't quite up to date on what naval procedures might be. Anyway, everybody seemed to live through it, as I say. Assiniboine was commanded at that time by Captain G.C. Jones, who shortly afterwards became a Commodore First Class, which is a very confusing rank that used to exist in the RCN. In that the dress is that of a rear admiral, but he isn't. He's really a captain, basically, and can revert at any time.
Ah.
And this confused a lot of people, of course, because he went around looking like an admiral, and actually he wasn't. He was also the commander of the Halifax Force, as it was called. And as such, he had more administrative duties than he had warlike duties, I suppose. And the result of that was that Assiniboine practically never seemed to go to sea. And of course, this is also why he got to be known as Jetty Jones, because he was always tied up to number three jetty. And this is very hard for the rest of us to live down, because we didn't really enjoy this role at all, because we see our confreres going out and coming back and going out and coming back and doing the things that naval people were supposed to be doing in time of war.
I suppose you never really operated as a flotilla at all.
No, never. There were never enough, you see, anyway, because convoys were becoming more and more frequent and larger, and we had far too few escorts to do it properly, so you scraped the bottom of the barrel every time a convoy sailed, and it didn't matter what organization a ship belonged to, she was grabbed and put to work.
Meantime, you were keeping a vessel tied up a lot of the time.
Yes. Mm-hmm. We did go out from time to time, a little bit more than from time to time, but we didn't run as hard as I had been used to in Saint-Laurent. We were at sea for 105 days of the first 120. Hmm. In fact, we were the second highest sea time ship in all the Royal Navies, the RN, the RAN, and so on. We, if you remember, were the ones who arrived in Halifax just in time to take the first Canadian convoy out.
Oh, yes.
And we went on from there. But Assiniboine is another kettle of fish, but when we did go to sea, of course, we did the same routine. We took a convoy out 3 days and then raced home again, sometimes through thick fog, which was rather unnerving, because there was always fog off Halifax in those days, at that time of year. And taking a convoy out through fog is quite bad enough, but coming back through it at 25 knots is almost worse.
Yeah.
I think Captain Jones had, or Commodore Jones, I should call him, had the theory that the faster you went in the fog, the quicker you got out of it.
Yeah.
Which is all very well, provided you didn't meet somebody else going the other way. I do remember going past Sambro Light Vessel at 25 knots at about 50 feet. Well, the crew apparently were going to abandon ship stations. I can hardly blame them, because we disappeared as soon as we appeared, so to speak, as far as they were concerned.
Yeah.
It must have been very frightening for them.
I should say. I suppose it was the Commodore busy on other matters a good deal of time. You, in effect, ran the ship. I mean, you
yes.
probably would anyway, but
yes.
I mean, it was probably more, was it, in this
case? I suppose so, yes. I suppose I hadn't thought about it, actually. Mm-hmm. But he had a couple of staff officers. Stubbs, who was a navigator, and Medland, who was a flotilla G, and also the senior staff officer, the chief staff officer, I suppose. And Medland was apt to take charge if given a chance, and exercise command of the ship in a way. But actually, Jones always went to sea with the ship, so when it came down to it, when actually things were happening, he was always there. He was in harbor with the administratively where everything fell in my lap, really, which was good value for me.
Yeah. I'd
learned an awful lot.
Right.
Stood me in good stead later.
As when you were operating in a flotilla leader, any special problems that you ran across that you would not have otherwise?
Well, there would have been had we been properly organized as a flotilla, in that the first lieutenant of the leader is always the sort of leading first lieutenant. And the other first lieutenants defer to his judgment on many matters of administration in order that all the ships will be doing the same thing at the same time. And there was a certain amount of that, which was a little odd, because I was not only the first lieutenant of the senior ship, but I was probably the most junior first lieutenant.
Oh, really?
At this point. So it didn't please some of my confreres very much, having to go by what I said. But Jones always backed me up, so that if there was a contention, it was always easily solvable. I seldom was. I had another funny job at that time, too. I was also appointed as a flotilla signal officer, without having specialized in signals. But as it was known that I was going to, when the opportunity offered, they decided that now was a good time for me to find out something about it in the field, so to speak. Well, I didn't mind. I got another 35 cents a day for this. And I really had practically nothing to do, because there was nothing to do. Again, because we were not really organized properly as a flotilla. So it was 35 cents a day, which was big stuff in those days for very little. Yeah. And I think it helped me a little later on, probably, maybe.
You did say you had a little more wireless equipment aboard, and that's a little...
Yes.
...than normal.
Mm.
And that was in order that you could... Because of the volume of traffic, you needed 2 sets, or what was it?
Yeah, that sort of thing. A flotilla leader... like a flagship. It is like a flagship in the junior scale, and consequently her requirements for communications are greater than those of the private ships which she is running. And this is why Assiniboine was outfitted in this manner. Had we been running, as she had been running in the RN as a leader of a flotilla, there is always a requirement for the leader to be able to talk to more people than for a private ship to, who doesn't need to, if she has to talk to her boss, virtually.
Did you, when you did go out on convoy escort, how far were you going? Were you going part way and picking up, and somebody else picked up the convoy, or did you go all the way to the UK?
No, it was usually about 3 days out. Mm-hmm. What we were really doing was clearing the focal area, because it was reckoned that if there were U-boats in the Western Atlantic, which at that time there weren't, but we didn't know that, if there were, then their best hunting ground would be in the focal points off the eastern seaboard. That is to say, off New York, off Halifax, off the mouth of the St. Lawrence, and off St. John Newfoundland. And when you stick all those together, you've got quite a large focal area. The New York one was outside our orbit. Halifax, St. Lawrence, and Newfoundland, of course, were inside our orbit. But, as I said, there were nowhere near enough ships. And so we took them out for 3 days and then said, bless you, my children, away you go. And off they would go across the Atlantic to be met about 3 days out of the UK by the UK forces, because escorts on that side of the Atlantic were in almost as short a supply as they were in ours. And don't forget, as we were saying the other day, that in the middle of this convoy was probably an R-class battleship, which gave them a comfortable feeling, if nothing else, in case of raiders.
But the battleship in itself didn't have any escort, as they normally would.
As they should normally have, yes.
Yeah.
They were shipped strictly there as a gunship. And it was during this time that the RA-3, the Rear Admiral Commanding the 3rd Battle Squadron, who were the R-class, established his headquarters in Halifax in a yacht which had been taken over, a very large steam yacht called Seabourn, HMS Seabourn, she became. And so we had the anomalous situation of a fairly senior Royal Naval Rear Admiral in a Canadian port, which also was the headquarters for a Commodore who was the commander of the Canadian naval area. It was Commodore Reed at the time. Commodore Jones was afloat down at Jetty 3. And Seabourn lay at, I think, Jetty 4, I forget now. So we had this rather odd situation and a national problem, really, and rather a tricky one, I should think. I was junior enough to not mind too much about it or even know too much about it.
Mm-hmm.
I think at the political level, it must have been a real hair-raiser.
It may well have been, yeah.
And funnily enough, the RA-3 had been my captain when I was midshipman in Sussex, Admiral Bonham Carter. So this did me a lot of no harm at all, because he was very kind and used to invite me to lunch quite often when he had prominent guests of world renown in some cases. So I met a lot of people which were most unusual circumstances. Most interesting.
Yeah. And how long were you in Assiniboine?
Only about 6 months, actually, because in November I was sent over to England to do a long signal course.
I think you said you had been sort of waiting for the opportunity or the opening to appear before you.
Yes.
You had applied for this sometime.
Oh, yes. Yes, indeed. I don't remember when I had applied, but sometime before.
Yeah, that's the branch you decided you wanted to specialize in.
Yes.
And you were, of course, a lieutenant.
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So you left Assiniboine and to England on the long signal course?
Yes.
Okay. Where was it?
In Portsmouth.
Mm-hmm. What ship were you attached to there? What
Victory was.
Oh, yeah.
She was a the barracks of Portsmouth was called HMS Victory, and Nelson's old ship, the Victory, was the flagship, was the depot ship, I should be saying,
really, yeah,
for Portsmouth as a whole. And then the Commander-in-Chief Portsmouth flew his flag in Victory, in her basin down in the dockyard there. We were in the signal school, which was in the barracks, actually, in the Royal Naval Barracks, and had been there ever since the signal school had been established in the 20s. It was pretty torn down, too. Most buildings in that part of the world at that time were in a horrible state of repair, and of course the war didn't do anything to help them along.
Well, this has been wintertime, then?
Yes, I...
Dreary weather?
Yes, very dreary weather. Again, like my time as a cadet, I arrived over there too soon, and I arrived over there this time too soon. I didn't have much to do, and I went down to the signal school and sat in on some classes of other people doing patch-up classes just for something to do until Christmas, when I went and stayed with relatives, and I came back. The course actually began on the 2nd of January, I guess. And on the 5th of January, we had our first big night blitz.
What generally were conditions in England when you were sort of knocking about at a loose end? What, anything you could say about that particularly?
Not particularly, no, because the really rationing and so on had not been going for long enough to make it really bad. It was getting bad.
This was late 1940 and January 1941.
The war had been going for 15, 16 months, so the bite was beginning to be felt all right. But also, people were beginning to settle into their stride. Because, you see, it was after the daylight blitzes, it was after the Dunkirk affair, and it was after the main threat of invasion had passed, England was really settling into its role as being the bastion of the free world, and building up its forces for the next phase of retaliation and taking on the Germans again. The Germans at this time started night blitz efforts, and Portsmouth was blitzed, as I say, on the 5th of January, after we'd been there only 3 or 4 days. And it was a good one, and it was really quite a blitz. And it was a rude introduction to me, particularly. I think I was the only one who'd arrived from overseas. There was another Canadian in the course, Bobby Murdoch, but he had been stationed in Britain up until, I think he had joined from an RN ship. I don't really remember. But anyway, the rest of them were all RN.
Were you all the same rank?
We're all lieutenants, widely divergent seniority. I think the junior one, who was the junior one, I don't remember. Maybe Bobby, I think. Had about a year in as a lieutenant, and the senior one had about 7 years in. Well, in those days, you became a lieutenant commander automatically after 8, so... Michael Cullen Seymour was pretty close to being a lieutenant commander.
Yeah. What did you take? What sort of courses did you take there? What did
it teach you? Everything you can think of about communication. The visual communication and wireless communication are two different kettles of fish.
Yeah.
And in the very early days of radar, so we were only given an introduction to radar. Nothing much to do with it. But there's quite enough to do in the intricacies of even visual communications is much more tricky and erudite requirement than you would ever believe. The movement of fleets has to be done properly, or else they get gummed up. And some of the stuff we learned were never used again. Some of the stuff was used, particularly the BPF, British Pacific Fleet, at the end of the war. And quite a lot of it, well, indeed, a great deal of it was used, as I know from experience later on, in the home fleet, when the fleet went to sea as a group instead of as little dribbles.
But it wasn't really applicable to your kind of...
Well, not to what I had been doing, but what I was to be doing, yes, it was. Yes, indeed, because I became a flotilla signal officer in the Royal Navy after a while. After my long course and after being on the staff at the signal school for a few months, I was sent to sea as the signal officer of the 17th Flotilla.
Oh, so you didn't return to Canada then?
Not immediately, no.
You actually got some practice in...
Yeah, before I came back, yeah.
Yeah. Wireless communication, they have the very latest sort of stuff there?
Yes, they had everything. They're ready from the old stuff. What they did, really, This is, because it was early wartime, this is a rather truncated long course. A long course had historically taken about a year and used every bit of it. We only did about 6 months, and we certainly used every bit of that, because it was very difficult for them to cut down the syllabus into virtually in half. One of the things that did suffer, unfortunately, was the mathematics, which is really of a very high caliber because of the intricacies of electronics and so on. You need, because the signal officer has to be in a position to teach others. It isn't just a case of scraping through. He has to know what he's doing so that he can tell other people how it works and so on. So cutting down mathematics was not a very good thing, but it had to be done. I found it pretty difficult personally, because I hadn't had as much mathematics in my background as the other fellows had.
That's just our garbage truck again.
Oh, well.
I'll just shut the window
first. So, are you... At this time, in 1940, the newest stuff that became run-of-the-mill later of ultra-high frequency and the very high frequency and so on wasn't really in the market yet. We did have some VHF equipment, not very much, and most of it was very little of it was done by Morse, by voice. Most of it was done by Morse, and consequently we had to learn Morse. And this took the 6 months, really, because you had to be able to take Morse at 22 words a minute.
Mm-hmm.
And if you know anything about it, that's really very fast indeed.
I think we'll just pause here until this noise.
I don't know what more there is to say about the long signal course. It was what it says. It was the longest course in signals. It qualified officers to be signal officers, to teach others, and to be the signal staff officer to admirals, commanding squadrons, and fleets, and so on. And it was the basis for the career for all 10 of us from there on.
There were only 10 of us
in the course, yes. One from the Royal Indian Navy, two the RCN, and seven from the Royal Navy.
If you successfully completed this course, you did what?
I went on to the staff at the signal school as what was called W3. That was number three staff officer on the wireless side, radio side. This staff too was split into two, the V side and the W side, and I was on the W side. At this time, or during my tenure of office there, the signal school moved from Portsmouth to a large country mansion up near Petersfield to get away from the bombing, which it did very successfully, except that whilst they're converting this house to its new role, a German aircraft jettisoned into a landmine not far away, in fact down in the orchard, which didn't do the building an awful lot of good, because it was then discovered the building was very jerry-built.
It shook it up very well,
and it was really rather unfortunate too, because one of the two survivors of Hood blowing up had been sent to this place. He was a telegraphist. Been sent there because it was nice and quiet in the country, and he was not very far away from this thing when it went off, and it didn't do him much good either. In fact, it shook him up so much that he went around the bend for a little bit.
Did he?
Yeah.
Oh,
it was, you know, it's really unfair.
Yeah.
And, however, we moved up there in August or so, I guess it was. I really don't remember, but at any rate, we did.
August of 41?
And it's still there today.
The signal school. What were your duties as a W3?
Instructing sub lieutenants and setting and marking examinations for men ratings, the lower levels of their career. In general, dog's body really, because I was not junior staff officer in the school or anything. Came along, and the steering was elected to do it, if it was unsavory or anything.
What was the rank of the captain of the school?
He was a captain.
He was a captain.
Four-stripe captain, yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And there was a commander who was the administrative head of the school, and there was a commander who was the head of the signal side of the school. There were all three of them signal officers, but one of the commanders administrative, and the other one was operational, so to speak.
What would the complement of the school that be, and how many students would you have at a time? Actually, in
the
situ.
There'd be several hundred students,
mm-hmm.
because it did courses for anybody, able seamen and above, for the Portsmouth Port Division. The Devonport Port Division and the Chatham Port Division had signal schools which did their lower instructions there. When it got up to above the rank of petty officer, from all three divisions came to us. And all the officers' training pretty well was done at Lay Dean, as it was called. HMS Mercury is her proper name.
Oh, yes.
I'd have to guess at the size of the staff or the size of the ship's company, but 100 odd, I should think.
Yeah.
That's a real guess.
Must have been quite a job moving, particularly getting all the equipment established in this new place.
It was a real horror, yes.
Yeah.
In wartime, and the lack of transportation, and if you managed to chisel some trucks out of somebody or other, then inevitably something would happen and you wouldn't get them. I don't know why the people who... I wasn't really responsible for it. All I had to do was move my class and myself virtually.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody else had to do all the nasty stuff. I was glad it wasn't me.
Yeah, right.
But once we were up there, it was beautiful. It's lovely countryside. Around Petersfield, I don't know if you know it, but it is really beautiful. The only problem was that there was absolutely nothing to do when you weren't doing your thing, when you weren't teaching or doing your duties.
Except for the wardroom, there was nowhere to go or nowhere to...
Nowhere to go, and there was nobody in it when you got there, because I think I was the only officer who was living in, really.
Oh, my.
It was a very lonely affair, and I was delighted when eventually I was sent off to sea. And
when were you sent to sea?
I think this was September. You know, it's funny how you forget these things.
Oh, well, that's funny. You were there only then...
A very short time,
yes. A short time,
yes.
Couple
yes.
of months or something.
Yes,
yeah.
That's all. Heaven be praised.
Well, I think we'll cut off here for a minute, and I'm just going to change tapes.
All right.
Okay?
All right.